I'm delighted to be here, and I'd also like to add my thanks, especially to Jenny Leckie-Thompson, who managed to coordinate so much of the activity we needed to make tonight possible. So, as Simon said, I'm a philosopher of mind and language, but I'm also very interested in the nature of taste. And having a passion for wine, it seems to me that one can both enjoy one's passion and actually exercise one's philosophical interests at the same time profitably, at least until the second bottle. Tim Crane and I, ex-colleague from London, who's now with you, always says, yes, it's the second bottle one always regrets. It's that moment of turning when you decide to open one more. But tonight we're going to be modest. You have in front of you two wines. I would ask you not to do anything with them until I, in a very draconian way, tell you what I would like you to do with them, so that we can all enjoy roughly the same conditions and same experience, and then see what conclusions we can draw from that. Okay, so I think there's an issue here that philosophers should be interested in, and I subtitled the talk From Science to Subjectivity. Why? Well, because there's a sort of question that comes up, I think, for anybody who's kind of had any debate or dispute with somebody else about whether the wine they were drinking was good or bad or indifferent. We often wonder whether the flavors of a wine are actually determined by its microchemical elements. Is it the chemical composition of a wine that gives it the flavors it has? Or is it that the taste, as it were, of the wine is really much more a matter of a subjective human response? It's something that you bring to the event of sipping the wine. And if that's right, is it the case that how the wine tastes depends on who is tasting? In particular, is it the case that different people will have different levels of ability in tasting? People will be expert tasters, and their proficiency, we might wonder where they get that from, and we'll talk about that later, their proficiency gives them a different experience to you. Well, if you think that a taste is going to be, as it were, settled by just the experience individuals have, and that it can vary, then you really don't think there's going to be anything very objective or anything very determinate about the qualities or properties or features of a wine. But I want to resist that quite strongly. Well, what is it that we are talking about when we think of the chemical composition? Notice we go beyond the wine in the bottle. The wine in the bottle has a long history. How it got there and where it got there from are very important. It's very rare parts of the surface of the earth on which we can make good wines. There are new wines coming in new areas all the time, but nevertheless they're climatically bound. I went to Norway recently and went to a restaurant that specialised in entirely local produce, and when I was offered a glass of wine, I immediately concluded it wasn't made from grapes, and indeed it wasn't. It was made from elderberry flower and rhubarb. So, and then I was forced to taste something the chefs rather like, which is a wine made from leeks, and I really don't recommend that either at all. Oops, this is annoying. I don't know if we can get this to disappear. We seem to be in a hot spot. So, what is it that's part of the history? Well, part of the history seems to be that we're interested in the places on the earth where we grow wine. And of course, the French have made this really almost a cult when they talk about the terroir, the particular place and culture and tradition where wine is grown. So here you're looking at Chablis, you're looking at a church in Chablis on one of the hills, and people will tell you that here is made a wine from the Chardonnay grape which cannot be made anywhere else on earth apart from here. That there are characteristics in the geology of the soil which has been developing and laid down over thousands of years, and then there's the way in which the particular roots and rootstocks have grown there, digging down into the earth to find some water. And remember, the rootstocks, the roots of a vine are about 25 meters long. It's a very, very deep contact they have with the ground in which they find themselves. So people will say it's the terroir. It's the place that has an importance. So on the one hand, we've got chemical composition, which isn't just in the bottle, but stretches back to the conditions of growing in which the the vines were produced that produced the grapes that were transformed into wine and eventually into what we drink in front of us. But there's also this perceptual experience we have as tasters. So people will sometimes say that whatever the French say about terroir, this is a rather romantic notion. And it might even affect the way you feel about the wines that you're drinking, but it's not going to have such an impact on flavour. For example, funnily enough, when you're drinking wines from Chablis, the common thing to say is that they're very flinty. They're rather green. They have a kind of green ripeness. They have a flinty mineral austerity to them. And yet, although people talk about the wines as being flinty, there is no known process in biochemistry that gets you from the geology of the rocks in which the vines are planted into the juice of the grape. In fact, the only way it could get in there is actually having a little bit of rock dust on the skin of the grape, but not much more. So it's interesting. Whatever we mean by terroir, it's not a very straightforward transmission of these properties of the geology into the grape. So is it more a matter of sort of romance and association? Well, we might wonder, because of this, whether tastes and flavours should be identified with the chemistry of wine, or whether they should be identified with just perceptual states of us. Well, in the chemistry of wine, as I said, there's soil character. Here's a bit more of the Chablis soil, the Kimmeridgian limestone, which is rather different from other places in Burgundy. It's also geographically separated from the rest of Burgundy. Chablis sometimes doesn't even describe itself as Burgundy. It describes itself as Chablis, and then there's the rest of Burgundy. And the people in central Burgundy, in the Côte d'Or, say the people from Chablis are the Corsicans of Burgundy, that they only call upon them when they need something. This is the rude thing they say about Chablis. Okay, so it's a very different geology. It's actually physically separated from the rest. There's the climate. Climate's terribly important, especially for the wines you're going to drink now, which are Pinot Noirs and like a very cool climate. They don't like anything too hot. If you get them too hot, they're going to roast the grapes and give a rather burned characteristic to them. So they like climates where it can get hot in the summer, but it tends to cool down in the evening, and the winters can be pretty bleak. Hence this rather ironic poster, which is to be found outside Chambord-Musigny, which says, "Remercie la nature," thank you nature, for Chambord-Musigny. The Burgundians are very proud of their product. Okay. So climate matters, and not everywhere can you grow Pinot Noir. Vine and rootstock matters, and you will know about phylloxera having almost wiped out a lot of the French vineyards, and therefore they replanted with American rootstock, which was resistant to phylloxera. So here you see some of the rootstock exposed. But of course we have to add this chap, because we mustn't forget human endeavour. You hear a lot of winemakers these days saying wine is a natural product. It's a natural product. And they often say, some of the best winemakers we know often say, the less you can do, the less intervention there is, the better the wine. As if the wine made itself, as if these ingredients got together. But look, the grapes would not be transformed into an alcoholically fermented drink that we then enjoy unless there was a great deal of human knowledge, a great deal of human skill. People who just go to sleep and leave their grapes to rot do not make good wines, whatever the talk of natural winemaking is. It might be interesting, but it's not particularly nice. So winemakers have all the decisions at hand. They can think about the viticulture. When you go through vineyards in Burgundy, and that's why I'm going to concentrate on Burgundy, because Burgundy offers you an immediate lesson in the contrasts you get between the choices that winemakers face. Because of the French Revolution, the vineyards in Burgundy were given from the aristocracy or the church to the peasants, and because of the Napoleonic laws, where sons had to inherit equally, the vineyards were divided and divided and divided, so that people have maybe two parcels or one parcel, three rows of a vineyard. They conquer this problem of scarcity by marrying each other, and then when you see the names go together, they're very happy. What goes on here is that you will sometimes see in a vineyard three rows of vines where the tops have been cut off. That's to let the sun get to them. That's called green harvesting. The grapes will ripen in the sun. Right next door is another three vines which have got their tops growing very high and which are being depleted of their extra leaves and their extra bunches, so that they search for more concentration into what remains. And then the next guy might even be spraying his vines. He might not have any concern with nature. He might be resisting this movement to organic and biodynamic. So you can see these three very different treatments in the vineyard. And when I saw this on the hill of Corton when I was walking around, I said, oh, I'd like to try the wines from these three different guys just to see what the difference makes to the bottle. But I was told immediately, well, that wouldn't be a good test because they might vinify differently. They might actually handle the wines differently in the vineyard once they get the crop in. So there are many, many factors, many variables. So this is going to make a difference to the wines we drink too. And of course, this is the other thing that makes a huge difference. Once you've made a wine, putting it into oak barrels and letting it mature, letting it grow up, this is the élevage. This is where you leave the wines to rest, and chemical processes continue to go on. The second fermentation, the one that takes you from malic acid to lactic acid, malolactic, that goes on slowly and steadily inside the barrels and silently. I know winemakers in Burgundy who say they creep down around Easter to just stay with their barrels and feel the change coming on them. And you know, there's an awful lot of fans talk about this. But again, there's choice. They choose the kind of barrels they use. They choose, do I take a barrel from the Allier forest, from the Vosges? Do I take French oak, American oak, Slovenian oak? Now, once I've chosen my oak, do I want a medium roast or a high roast for the barrels when they're roasting the inside? And of course, that will depend on the vintage. Some vintages you want a higher roast, some which are very delicate vintages and rather less promising years, you want a medium roast. And they also choose which tonnellary they use, who's making the barrels, because some people have more skill at this than others. Lots of my fellow countrymen, my Scottish kinsmen, went over and made very good livings sitting beside both winemakers in France and winemakers in California when the whiskey trade had gone down and down and down in the 1970s. They reinvented themselves as expert practitioners at the service of winemakers. Now, again, in Burgundy, winemakers often say you have to be a lover in the vineyard and a father in the cellar. So you have to bring up your children. You have to, once you've made the most you can and coaxed what you can out of your grapes into the wine, when you leave it here, that's where patience and delicacy is involved. There are many things you can do. The wines in the barrels, the alcohol will eventually evaporate, leaving more oxygen. The more oxygen it leaves, the more you oxygenate the wine, and that tends to oxidize it, turning it towards sherry. If you starve it of oxygen by refilling the barrels, less oxygen means that the oxygen in the wine is getting eaten up by the dying yeasts, and that will lead to a reductive smell, often the smell of struck match, sulfurous smell. You've got to get that balance just right. You also sometimes, if you need to give your wine more flavor, you stir the lees, batonnage. So you go in there and you stir the lees on the bottom to give more flavor, to add more complexity to the wine. So lots of decision making. It's simply not the case that this is a natural product that makes itself. But now I hope you're seeing the complexity that we get to when we want to try to go from, oh, is it just the chemical composition of the wine, to how it tastes. There are many things that have gone on before that. And of course, when we don't just think all the subjectivities at our end and all the objectivities in the chemistry of the wine, because of course there's science to be done about us. You want to look at the science of the taster. You want to look at some of the things going on in the brain of a taster and what makes it possible for us to have these exquisite experiences. Okay. So, question. What can we taste in a wine? What can we taste in a wine? And I think to get the evening off to start, so that you can relax, you can sort of enjoy yourself a bit more, and I will feel that I see more smiles on the faces, I think now we're going to sort of pause to have a little practical so that we see what's in front of us. Now, on your left-hand side, you have got a French Pinot Noir. This is a 2006 wine from the Haute Côte. Haute Côte is behind the hills you see here. Here are the hills of Burgundy. here's the Côte d'Or, which stretches along and faces southeast, so it gets the sun in the morning and then less in the evening, so the grapes can have a chance to cool down and retain their acidity. So you've got this business about grapes ripening. When fruit ripens, it gets sweeter, more sugar, but of course it loses its acidity. Think of a strawberry. If you eat a strawberry and it's not quite ripe, it's sour and tart. But if you eat it when it's too ripe and it's mushy, it's sort of sweet but rather unpleasant because it hasn't got that nice zing, that nice sharpness, the tartness that you want. So fruit is losing its acidity and gaining its sugar. And the winemaker has to judge at what moment have you got the ideal balance between the two. But when you've got grapes ripening in the daytime and cooling down at night, they can retain their acidity. Less easy to do in Australia, California, and as we'll see in New Zealand. Now, Burgundy, Idiot's Guide to Burgundy, quality is entirely determined by position in the landscape. The stuff on the flat here is what we call village wine. So the wines made from here will have the name of famous villages: Gevrey-Chambertin, Chambon-Musigny, Alos-Corton, Maurice-Saint-Denis, and so on. Now, very interesting, because those villages were villages that attached their name to famous vineyards. Chambertin was a famous vineyard. It actually meant the field of the Chambon de Bertin, the farmer, Chambertin. And there's this famous vineyard that makes a very beautiful Grand Cru Burgundy. But the village wanted to get in on the fame, so it called itself Gevrey-Chambertin. And then the other villagers thought, that's a good trick. So there's this Musigny as well, which is a very famous vineyard. So Chambon calls itself Chambon Musigny. There's Corton, Corton Charlemagne, white, Corton red. So Alos calls itself Alos Corton. You're beginning to see how it goes. And then there's a little bit of a fight for Montrachet. The Montrachet vineyard is claimed both by Chassin and by Pouligny. Pouligny Montrachet, Chassin Montrachet. Okay. So whenever you have a village wine, it's made from here. It's in the plain. That's where the grapes are. Now, the vineyards that are up here, or as it were, the vineyards and the wines that are up here, why are they so good? They're so good when they're right up here because they have got lots of drainage. So this is a rainy, wet climate, but all of the soaking soil is draining out of it. That's good. But it's not good if it takes all of the nutrients with it. Right? So if all the nutrients go, it's good to have drainage. Otherwise, down here can be a bit mulchy, maybe a bit wet, a bit dilute. You can dilute the fruit a little bit down here. But up here, good drainage. But of course, if you drain too much, you lose the nutrients. But the nutrients tend to slide down to the middle part of the slope. So guess what the classification is? Classification is village, premier cru, and top, grand cru. Grand cru in the middle, premier cru at the top, village at the bottom. Determined by the geography. Very easy. Okay. So whenever you go into your wine merchant, you see premier cru and grand cru, you think, what is that? Quality stuff. It's got drainage, but it's got the nutrients. It's got it's losing its nutrients, but it's got good drainage, and here it can be a bit mulchy. Except in 2007, which was otherwise a lousy year, we're actually very wet on the coat and actually quite dry in the plain. I learned this from an ex-Formula One mechanic in Scott called David Clark, who's now making wines in Burgundy. And he was a very philosophical young man. He said to me, I said to him, you know, I'm interested in tasting, and as a philosopher, what goes into tasting? And he said, well, tasting should just be confirming what you already know. If your vines are healthy and your fruit is healthy and you vinify properly, you shouldn't really need to taste. You'll know it's a quality wine. It's an engineer's view of wine, but it's a kind of fascinating one, right? The idea is it's all set by the chemical composition. So he doesn't have any worries of the sort we have. He thinks it's determined by this and the way he has, the choices he has made. So we're going to taste. All right. So I want you to just do a little bit of a sort of little exercise with me. Having the two wines in your hand, and before you stir them or shake them, just when they're unstirred, non-shaken, just sniff. So we'll try sniffing the one in our left hand, the one in your left hand first. And then compare that with the smell of the the one on your right hand. Same or different? In what way? How are they different? The second?
The left is more
perfumed. Right? Left is quite delicate. Yeah? The right is a darker note. Do you think darker? Darker, deeper, slightly more on the charcoal sort of notes than gravel notes than the other. The other one's lighter sort of perfume note. Now, the one you have in your right hand, I better do this with you. The one you have in your right hand, the darker smelling one. That's the one from New Zealand. That's the New Zealand Pinot Noir. Now, the fruit there is definitely riper. And I even think it smells a little bit like the berries are a little bit roasted. You can sort of almost smell they're getting... you can imagine grapes that just get a little bit hot and the skins get a little bit thicker and they're just a wee bit towards the sort of cooked fruit stage. Now, not too much, but... noticeably different from the other. There is almost always a contrast, not always, but almost always a contrast between New World and Old World, because in the Old World, in Europe, we don't have such good climate. So the fruit sometimes doesn't get ripe. There's sometimes just a little bit of greenness. But people in Europe, in winemaking, like that because they like the fact that it gives a certain complexity and delicacy to the smells of the fruit. The fruit from Australia, California, very hot climates, tends to be riper, richer, much more intense. And of course, 9 times out of 10, they have a good season and everything goes well. But they like their fruit to be ripe. And there's a big debate, which is almost a philosophical debate, between two schools about what ripeness is. You might think ripeness is just a kind of, ripeness is just an objective measure. Is the fruit ripe? But there's a big difference between what the Americans call the hang time of the fruit in California and what people in Burgundy think should be the time to pick. If you're being very abusive, people will say things like this. Look, what's the end? What's the telos? What's the end of ripening? The end of ripeness is deadness. Things die when they're overripe. That's what happens. It falls from the tree. It's dead. So sometimes if you leave the fruit too long, you take a bit of the freshness and life out of it. So according to the Burgundy makers, they think it's here. But one of the great Burgundy makers, Aubert de Villaine, who makes Domaine de la Romanée-Conti, his view is, and this is a very interesting kind of metaphysical thesis, really, if you think of it. His view is, the grape doesn't stop ripening when you pick it. The ripening process goes from when you're picking the grape on the vine, fermenting the fruit, and then putting it into bottle, first of all into oak and then into bottle. And those wines go on ripening. You know, that's why they last. That's why you can keep them for 15, 20 years, where you often can't do that with some of the more forward, more accessible, easier to drink wines. So, we've got this contrast, but we'll see whether it shows up. Now, I said to you to do it still. Now I want you to see, take one of the wines, and then on the table, just by, if you circle it round to agitate it, see if you get a change in the aroma when you... Is it different? Try still and then shape it. Same? Different? More intense? A little more. It's a little dumb on the nose. There isn't that much that I think in the... This is the Burgundy Pinot Noir. It's a little dumb on the nose. But I think what you get at first... You should always do this. When you're going to test the wine, don't shake it. People pick it up and they've seen other people do this. And they think, this is what you're doing. You're fancy. They pick it up and they swirl it like this. Stick their nose in it. Try still first, then agitated and smell. First nose, second nose, they're different. What you'll get at first is the most volatile wines, the ones that can punch their way through the ethanol and can reach you. They're going to be the most volatile. That'll tell you if there are any faults. It'll tell you something about the kind of quality of the winemaking. Then when you agitate it, the more delicate aromas and odors break free when you agitate, when you let those out. And it's nice to contrast, you get more of the fruit notes on the second, in the second nose. So try it with the other one. So we've tried it with one, we'll try it with the other. Okay. Now we're going to test something that many people talk about, and I'm going to talk about it too. Often people say, isn't taste just smell? Isn't taste just smell? Taste is just smell. This is one of the things that people say. You lose your sense of smell, you lose your taste. Now, I want you to taste the wines, tasting the one in the one on the left first, and just see whether it confirms what you think it's going to taste like from how it smells. Now, tasting is not drinking. All you need to do is take something the size of a teaspoon into your mouth and roll it around, and just concentrate on what's happening as it travels to the back and you swallow. What do people make of that? What do you get from that? Slightly metallic, little metallic notes, which is not, that'll calm down, that'll go away, but it's not terrifically nice. It slightly spoils something, and you didn't get that, I think. You don't get any of the iron notes really on the nose. Okay, so here's something that surprises you on the palate, not the same as the nose. Now we try the other one, see what we think. Big contrast, very different. So what do you think of that? Pudding-y, yes, yeah. It's kind of Christmassy, isn't it? It's got a kind of Christmas pudding, nice sort of Christmas pudding feel to it. But it's also, it's much fruitier. You get the fruit, I think, shows more. Definitely get that. But I still get those slightly burned flavors, just a little bit.
It's less tannic than
Yeah. Now, neither of these are terrifically tannic wines, both because they're rather simple Pinot Noirs. And Pinot Noirs got very thin skin. It's very thin-skinned. That's why if you try and make it in a hot climate and the skin toughens and thickens, it's not very nice, because you'll start to get rather bitter flavors out of the skins you don't want. When you have slightly more impressive fruit and in slightly better vineyards, you will have tannins, and you will have very gentle and subtle tannins. But you're right to say the French one has more tannins than this. Now again, I think the reason for that is because of ripeness. So the third clock that's running, remember we've got the clock for acidity. Acidity's falling all the time. And you've got ripening of the fruit, the sugar level is going up high. As well as that, you have the tannins, and the tannins are the polyphenols. And phenolic ripeness you're going for too. If you have phenols that are unripe, it gives it a sort of, again, slightly bitter, slightly green kind of note, a bit a vegetal note you don't want. So again, you're trying to get these three things right. Now, you can do chemical analysis on the acidity level, on the sugar level, the bricks, you can look at that. You can look at the polyphenols, you can have it sent away to the lab, and they do, and they have it analyzed, and all of the decent winemakers in Burgundy will send their things to the lab. But when you ask them, how do you know when to pick? They say, because I taste the grapes every day. I eat the skins and the pips. I chew them. The pips will tell me whether the phenols are ripe, because you're going to get the phenols out of the skins and out of the pips. So they eat the lot. So they spend a lot of money sending everything to the chemical lab, but at the end of the day, it's the human judgment. They say, now's the time to pick. Now, the second, I think, it's slightly overripe, and if it's overripe, then the tannins are a little more relaxed, and everything will have softened. And that's often what people want to do. Now, there's a little bit of oak. You can just smell. You can't really get the oak in the first, although it has had some oak. Yeah. You get a bit of vanilla, right. So in the second, you get a tiny bit, second note, you get a tiny bit of vanilla. And the vanilla is coming from the oak barrel. That's one of the flavors that the oak is imparting. So it's softening the tannins, and it's also imparting flavor. So here's the hill of Kortol. I just wanted to show you a pretty picture as well. You're swilling and tasting the wine. This is where I saw the three different vineyard, the three different ways of handling the vineyards, up here, just below the hill. And here are the good folk of Burgundy out picking in lovely conditions. All right, and of course the oak that we just talked about. The question is how much new oak do you use? Because new oak is going to give a lot of that vanilla flavor to your wine. So you don't want to use 100% new oak unless you've got a very, very powerful wine that can handle it. Some of the great vineyards in Burgundy, Jean Mayo of Mayo Camusé uses 100% new oak in his Premier Cruz. It's very daring. They don't overrun. I went and tasted his Premier Cruz because now that I've edited a book on philosophy of wine, this is, I'd recommend this to you. This is a good thing to do. This is a great way to get into the cellars of some of the great French vineyards. They're French. Ah, philosophy, ah oui, c'est bien sûr, c'est très important ça. So you get their philosophy of wine and you give them the book, but then you taste some really great things. Now, okay, so back to the thing. I said that we've just been tasting these wines and we're wondering, what can you taste in the wine? And I think there are three ways to put this question. What can you taste in the wine? What can you taste in the wine? What can you taste in the wine? Those are all different. So I want to call those the what, who, and how of tasting. And just see if there's a difference and how it might matter. Okay, so the answers to the questions interact. Is what can be tasted dependent on who's doing the tasting? That's one of the things I wanted to know. Is it that an expert taster like Robert Parker or Jancis Robinson is always going to taste things that we don't? Or is it that what can be tasted depends on how one's tasting? I'm going to try and incline you towards the latter and not settle for the view that great tasters are born. I think they're made. Okay. So let's start with the what question and consider two radically different views. Okay, different views. Taste is just a unique sensation. It's private and personal. It's just how things are. You know, what I'm now concentrating on, that's going on in me. After all, it's in my mouth. It's a sensation in me, so it's very personal. It's up close and personal. And that's contrasted with the view of the chemical analyzers and the enologists who you send your products off to, who think it's to do with the sapid and odorous substances. Okay. So we want to know which of these things it can be. Well, look, if taste is determined by chemical properties, how can people taste different things in the wine? So we were all very polite, and I'm hoping as the evening goes on you'll shout out more things, but when you taste the wines, somebody will say, you know, I get chocolate. And other people say, no, don't get that at all. Or some people will say, very often you give people a white wine when they're completely new to this, and they say, raspberry. You know. Okay. So then the question is, if people can taste different things, isn't that straightforwardly an argument for saying that taste is definitely something that depends on human perceivers? So how can the wine structure help us explain? Now look, there's a sort of paradox here, because a lot of money, a lot of science, a lot of time and attention and care is going into improving the practices of winemaking. Why would they be doing that if it's in the service of just leaving it in the hands of individuals to have random and idiosyncratic responses to it? I mean, shouldn't you just be working on marketing and advertising and kind of, you know, taste my Kangarooge, you'll really like it. Why not just do that rather than putting all this time into the vineyard? So there's a problem if we have the completely subjective view of taste. Now, But there's also a problem that the chemists face too. You can't tell what a wine tastes like simply on the basis of its chemical composition. And that's what I was saying about the winemakers when they want to decide, when should I pick? You know, they can know all the chemical analysis, but they want to taste. They want to know, when does it have the qualities I think are right to set this set of grapes on its journey to be crushed, to be fermented, to be put through proper care and then eventually bottled, all right? So they can't do it just by the chemical compounds. So we've got a very detailed description. Analytic chemists are great. Analytic chemists now with spectrometry, they can actually tell you whether there are compounds in your Vaughan Romanée that came from the Allier forest or from somewhere else. That's very fancy, right? But it's not getting them a reading of what the wine tastes like. But then you might think, well, that's because taste is subjective, so of course you weren't supposed to get that. Now, the trouble is that if you concentrate on the subjective responses of tasters, they seem incredibly fleeting, variable, subjective, and so they don't allow us to bridge this gap between the chemical composition and our perceptual experiences. And yet, it's very hard to shake the idea that, you know, it's what's going on in that wine. It's because you're making wine with pure fruit of such high quality in a particular place with extreme care that you're getting the experiences that you get. Because after all, these winemakers, when they put all this care into it, are doing it in the service of delivering a particular subjective experience to you, a better and better one. Okay, so there should be some relation between the two, surely. So how can we figure that out? How can we have these two things related to one another? Well, here's what got me started on this in the first place. I was interested in wine. I was reading a lot of criticism, and it drove wine critics who keep saying, well, of course, taste is subjective. And then having said this proudly, they would go on to recommend wines and classify them and rank them and say, this is better than that. You should buy this and not this. I mean, what are they talking about? So look, they know a lot about wine, far more than I do, far more than we do. But subjectivity and objectivity, that's our game. We're philosophers. That's our business. So when they start talking about wine being subjective, but they practice as if they could judge better and worse and rank wines, I think it's time for philosophers to go in there and look at what's going on. In other words, what do they mean? What do they mean? Because remember, critics claim often to taste this huge range of properties. They talk about the personality of a wine, its breed, its history, its place, its style, its quality, and some of the compounds. I mean, the descriptions are enormous. It's an incredible feat to see the tasting notes of the top wine critics. So what's going on? We've got this these two views of what taste could be. Taste is subjective, sensations in me. Taste is objective, features of the wine. Now, those two positions tend to go with novice and expert, right? So you might think, but I'm just going to tell, I mean, I've just told you that they don't really all the time, but novices tend to regard experts' descriptions as fanciful. So when you say, this is extremely pure fruit with a hint of cerise and a bit of licorice, slightly touched with a medium roasted oak, starting to show the signs of softening wood tannins, which are still forceful and present, but subtle and fine-grained and so on. People are saying, what are they talking about? What are they talking about? The expert, of course, is likely to believe, well, the ordinary person just doesn't understand or doesn't appreciate what's there. They haven't got the skill to find out what's there. So the novice is skeptical, but they're skeptical that people can taste those things in wines. They don't doubt the expert knows a lot, and they think that that knowledge is helping them to pile up the descriptions. But what they doubt is they're actually tasting that stuff. Okay. So is it true that experts can taste something novices can't? Is it just a matter of who's doing the tasting? Well, it isn't, as I said, so simple, because you get this subjective claim. Here's Michael Broadbent, a legendary wine taster for Christie's. I'm convinced that to talk about letting in total objectivity relating entirely to the external object in tasting is nonsense. Moreover, to be a subjective taster is nothing to be ashamed of. One could even argue that a subjective approach arising out of the senses is the most enriching approach to fine wine. And then he says, I, the taster, am the final arbiter. I take it that's the general I, and not, as it were, he's the final arbiter. But actually, at Christie's, he is. At Christie's, he is. And the people say, you know, actually, this wine is now fading. I think it's really on its downward slope. You know, you will take him. But look, here's a stout defense of the idea that it's all subjective. Very funny, coming from a person who's got a job to do. So, all right, so this is what I found puzzling. But food scientists and wine scientists even say the same thing. So here's a sort of, this is quoted again and again in a number of different wine writers and food scientists. Taste refers to sensations induced primarily by stimulation of receptors located on the surface of the tongue. So of course this goes with the novice's view. It's on my tongue, it's in me, it's a sensation I'm having, surely it's all about me. Now, well, I can see why people are tempted by the idea. I can see why they're tempted by it. And I can see why they think, look, given that taste is about sensations, if I don't have those sensations, then I'm really skeptical that other people do unless they're radically different beings to me. Okay. But I think we can taste what the expert does. And the tricky issue is to say why we don't know that we do, or why we fail to notice it. So we can do, and we can be brought to do it by tasting. Now, what's the perceived object of tasting? This is just, you know, okay, little homework exercise. Sounds are the objects of hearing. Feels are the objects of touching. Tastes are the object of tasting. That sound right? Maybe. Okay, let's see if that's right. So if the budget had stretched to it, we'd now be doing the second part, part two, with a fine Pliny Moriche. So take a Pliny Moriche, we pour it out, and I ask for impressions. And you say, you look at it, you say, golden, slightly honeyed nose, hazelnuts, rich and creamy, beautiful balancing acidity, just the right temperature, and a long, long persistent note of minerality after a swallow. And what's interesting to note about that is, do we just have gustatory sensations on the tongue? No. We're not talking just about gustation here. Not at all. We're talking about something being creamy. We're talking about something having the right temperature. We're even talking about aftertastes where nothing's actually going on in the mouth. The single harmonious effect of this wine is given to us with many modalities. Sight, smell, touch, vision, haptic, the haptic system, and the trigeminal system. So the trigeminal system is a nerve you have up here behind the bridge of the nose, and it's a nerve that goes off and rings when you eat a food that's too strong, or you're having a chili, or you have a mint, a peppermint in your mouth, and you feel it's cool, you feel it's cold, the peppermint. Of course your mouth isn't cool or cold at all, but the trigeminal nerve is doing something and it's telling you that's what's going on. Now you're using all of those when you taste wine. And the thing to notice about taste is it always involves taste, touch, and smell. It always involves taste, touch, and smell. Now we want to do a little bit of comparison. I want you to see now what's the texture of these wines. Just talk about the texture. So try with the left-hand one, the French one first, and then the other, and see if there's a difference between just the way it feels in the mouth. Any descriptions? Any thoughts, comparatively?
The second one is more the viscous. So it's a kind of, right. It's a time-dependent thing you do.
Yeah. It's fuller bodied, it's certainly fuller bodied. What's the, if you had to give a description of the texture?
The French one is grainier.
Grainier. Finer? Or rougher?
Rougher.
I'm not sure. I'd go the other way on that, but that's interesting. What? So, if you had to think of a fabric to describe this, what would it be? It's the French one. I think it's silky. You often hear wines described as being like velvet. This is not a velvet wine, but it's a sort of silk texture. Velvet's a very good description for much richer, much more sumptuous wines than this, and often for some of the most sumptuous wines of Bordeaux. One of my favourite descriptions ever by Jancis Robinson. Wonderful description. Shows you how a metaphor can do a lot of work. She had been at the ambassador, British ambassador's residence in Paris, had been drinking fabulous wines, and they ended up drinking a 1945 Chateau Petrus, and she was scribbling down her notes so that in the morning she would remember. And she wrote on her notes, and she looked at what she'd written for the Chateau Petrus, and she'd written, "Like velvet, but with a pattern on it." That's great. That's the wine you want to taste. Now that's where somebody's power of description is wonderful. So look, in this one, we're looking at it, it's golden. You're using your sense of smell, the honeyed nose. You're using your touch because it's creamy. It's got a feeling in the mouth, right? It's creamy. You're getting the temperature reading from the thermal reception and trigeminal, and also you're getting after images. You know, once you've swallowed. Now here's the funny thing, when you've swallowed and you say, "I still have a taste in my mouth," probably you do now. It's not a taste, it's a smell. It's not a taste. What you have now, when you talk about an aftertaste, is retronasal olfaction. It's when the aromas from the gullet are going back up and they pass through the nose in the opposite direction. Orthonasals, when you have a nice big sniff in, retronasals when it comes back the other way, and there are two sets, they're the same receptors, but they project differently to the brain. They fire differently depending on the flow of the air, which direction it's going in. Very, very interesting system. Now, you could say that we've got two senses of smell. One sense of smell in evolution is to smell things in the environment, predators, smoke. Another is to assess whether quality of what you've just eaten is good enough to have any more or to stop. And if you get an aftertaste, that gives you a very good reading. Bitter, stop now, or very good, very sweet, very satisfying, have more. So these are two different smell combined. And you use the retronasal one mostly in wine. So when people say taste is mostly smell, they mean retronasal smell. We know this because clever psychologists and food scientists have done experiments where you get an aqueous jelly that has no taste and it has an odor, and you put it in the mouth, and people cannot be dissuaded that this tastes of something, because of course it's purveying its odor retronasally. Okay, so you're using touch, taste, and smell, retronasal in particular. That's always going on in taste. So now, is the object of taste tasting? The object of doing tasting, object of seeing is, you know, some a look of something, of hearing is a sound, but a taste is now a very complicated thing because you've got to it by using three senses at least. And I think you're using more. This is crazy. Most people think I'm absolutely crazy. I think audition as well. I think good wine pours better than bad wine. I think the way it comes out of the bottle, it has a lovely and not just bleh. And therefore, I'm convinced that you can hear the difference. But most people think there's no physics behind this at all. But anyway, there we go. All right. So, the direct object of wine tasting is multimodal. It involves many senses, right? And you're coding in these different sensory modalities. So now we need a new word, and in food science and wine science, use the word flavor. Flavor is a technical word that is something which involves smell and also taste and touch. So flavor perception arises from this integration of the different sensory streams. And I can't resist giving you this definition from the International Standards Organization in France. They say flavor is to be defined as a complex combination of the olfactory, gustatory, trigeminal sensations perceived during tasting. The flavor may be influenced by tactile, thermal, painful, and or kinesthetic effects. Wow! Okay, that's a lot that goes into flavor. So this is something philosophers of perception should be very interested in and haven't been, because they tend to do the senses one by one. Oh, I'm the sound man, I do vision. And so my colleagues in London, who are very good at this, visual signs dominates. And you occasionally get people who do sounds. Some people maybe do a bit of touch. Some people are interested in the connection between sight and touch. famously in philosophy. But this is very complicated stuff, and it's very important. It's also one of our earliest senses and one of our most basic senses. We use it all the time, every day. If we don't have it, we're in trouble. So, the direct object of wine tasting is not just multimodal, but it involves cross-modal effects. So it's not just a combination of different sensory streams coming together. They affect one another. And these interactions are effects of temperature and texture on one another. Now, let me tell you a little bit about what cross-modality is. It's very easy to give you an example of cross-modal effects. You get it all the time in the cinema. In the cinema, you see a face talking to you and you think the sounds are coming out of that mouth. But of course, the sounds are not. The sounds are all around you. But your visual system is so dominant that you get visual capture. You see a mouth moving in synchrony with the sounds you hear, and so you just put the two together. The brain's job is put them together. That's why it was always annoying if things were just slightly out of sync. It destroyed the illusion and you couldn't bear it. It didn't work. But here's another thing that goes on. I mean, most of you may have noticed this, but if you haven't, I'm going to ruin every film for you. Sorry, but it's worth making the point. So nowadays, and it's, film editors have known this for a long time, at the end of every scene, before you move to a new scene, you often hear noises that belong with the new scene to prepare you. So you're in a kitchen and you hear a car start. There isn't a car in the kitchen. But then you move to somebody outside in their car. And you don't notice that. You just go with it. It seems to be okay. But now we've pointed it out. You say, oh yeah, I think I've seen that. And, you know, you look at it and you see. What that's doing is preparing the auditory system is giving a clue so that when you move visually, it doesn't seem like a jump cut. It doesn't seem so shocking. You're getting warmed up, in other words, to make a smoother transition. And films that don't do that look jumpy. So people have known that for a long time. The McGurk effect, Google it. I couldn't get it on my screen, but Google it and see it afterwards. Great effect. You're shown a film of somebody making the sound ga, ga, ga with their mouth. But what you're getting in auditory input is the sound ba. When you look at the mouth and you hear the sound, what you actually quote here is da. And it's very robust. You can go like this. Da, ba, da, ba, da, ba, da, ba. If your eyes see the mouth, they cannot hear it as ba. So do you hear with your eyes? Sort of. But what this is telling you, the brain has an awful lot of this going on. You're using information from many senses to kind of give you a unified product and to do the best you can with it. Okay, that goes on in wine all the time. And indeed, our language is full of it. You talk about vanilla as being sweet smelling. Sweet as a taste. What do you mean sweet smelling? Notice that you're easily moving from one modality to the other without really noticing. And because of that, there's something called the sweetness enhancement effect. This is very robust. You give people two wines or two liquids. You get them to rate them for sweetness, okay? Or you give them one liquid and you get them to rate it for sweetness out of 10. Now give them, they don't know it's the same sample, give them the same sample but having given them vanilla aroma. Now they say it's sweeter. Okay, so the aroma, and notice vanilla isn't itself sweet. That aroma is creating a new experience when you taste. Now, sounds can enhance taste. I love this. This was an experiment done in Oxford by Charles Spence with Heston Blumenthal. You get oysters. You cook the oysters. You fry them. You half them. And you have your subjects given half oysters on sticks. They don't know they're two halves of the same oyster. In one part of the experiment, they're listening to random noise. In the other part of the experiment, they're listening to the sounds of the sea. When they're listening to the sounds of the sea, the half of the oyster they're eating tastes saltier. Nice, okay? And this is why I'm told now at the Fat Duck, there's one course where you're given a little iPod and you're supposed to listen to sounds of the sea as you're eating. Okay. Charles Spence also got the Ig Nobel Prize for his work on crisps. This is also lovely. If you have people eating crisps and judging how fresh they are they fresh or are they a bit stale? If you get some stale crisps, but you boost the high frequency sound back to them of their crunching. The crisps taste crisper. Okay? Which is why they make those bags infuriatingly noisy, right? That's to give you the whole excitement and impression that you're having something quite fresh. So of course, sound can influence taste. Smell can influence taste. Back to subjectivity then, and to objectivity. So we want to know, is flavour in the bottle, or is it just a psychological construct now? Is it just I use all of these bits of my senses, and I make a big amalgam, and I make some sort of big product of the lot, and it's really just, again, subjective and about me? Well, if flavours are to serve as a bridge, flavours are these rather complicated things, involving taste and smell and other things. If flavours are to serve as a bridge between wine chemistry and our experience, they have to have a kind of well-behaved relation to both, okay? They seem to depend on us as perceivers and our brain doing certain things to put things together. So does that make them just subjective? No, no. So flavours are a perceptual category. Flavours are what tasters perceive in foods and in wines. But to describe them as perceptual categories, classifications of things in the world that we're interested in, doesn't mean they're therefore just subjective or they're just in our minds. A chair is a perceptual category. Dogs and cats and other animals don't break up the world into chairs and non-chairs. It is a perceptual category, a functional category for us. Depends on us that we find those things particularly interesting and isolate them from the rest of the environment. Doesn't mean that they're only in our minds. They're any less real physical objects. So flavours are things that we, with our apparatus, are interested in, but flavours are dependent on the wines which have them. Okay, that's the idea. So they're intermediate, and they reside between chemical compounds that go to make up a wine. They depend on them, but they're not exhausted by them, and our individual responses. Now, the relation is subtle and complex, very complex, and it needs a lot of work, and a lot of work is starting to be done, but until we appreciate it, you'll see why it was a bad idea to just say, how does a sensation, taste, and me relate to chemical properties of wine? No such simple relationship. Flavors are complex because they have these complex sensory profiles, but the profiles are created by wines which have aromas and odors and textures. The wines you tasted when you thought one was coarse and one was fine, the wines you thought had a silky characteristic, that's about the wines. You can't get that if the wine has a different origin, a different chemical property to it, is actually made with polyphenols of a different kind. Tannins. Tannins are very simple. When you have a very young Bordeaux of a very good vintage, you have these searing tannins, you have that mouth drying feel where, you know, it just seems to dry your mouth and you feel your mouth is less sort of frictive than it was. Perfectly good explanation. Tannins are polyphenols and they coagulate the protein on the tongue. And when the protein is coagulated, it's not as slippy, so the mouth feels dry and kind of squeaky in that way. Add some steak to the mouth, add more protein, and now things seem to get a little bit better, which is why when you're having a very tannic wine, you want to have a lot of meat, okay? They don't, however, like white fish. If you put young, vigorous tannins together with white fish, it'll make the wine taste metallic, okay? We can make those predictions, and they're right. It's the only reason for not having white fish with red wine or young red wine, okay? Now, the other thing about polyphenols is that they polymerize. So you've got these chemical compounds and they get together and they get into bigger and bigger chains. And when they get into chains that are so big, they're heavy and they fall to the bottom of the bottle. That's why you leave them until they do that. And then they take all of that tannic stuff out and you have a very softer, lighter, smoother product. Okay. Very easy to understand how the chemistry gives rise to the sensations we have, but not so easy for everything else. So we've got sweetness enhancement, we know that, we've just talked about that. Equally, tastes can enhance odour intensity, you can have experiments going the other way. Here's one of my favourites is also this quote from Prescott, where he says, such cross-modal effects show that not only does a sweet smell enhance, give you the feeling that what you're tasting is sweeter, it actually makes what you're tasting taste less sour. which is wonderful because it's playing exactly the same role as a sugar. So he thinks it is actually halfway between a taste and a smell. So let me just quickly get to where we're going to stop. So, taste and smells and textures interact. Here's another nice thing. You can change how creamy something is in your mouth by giving people different orthonasal aromas. It's a very nasty experiment, so you have to put the tubes down the back of their nose. But if you change the aroma they're getting, they can take something in their mouth that feels less or more creamy. That's a very surprising thing. So they're huge interactions. All right. So there are also super additive effects, which are now being studied in cognitive neuroscience. This is very nice. You give somebody sub-threshold aroma of vanilla and sub-threshold sweetness, and if you give them together, they taste sweet. It's very nice. Very nice effect. Right? So we need to know more about this. Given that viscous, things that are viscous, you said more viscous, taste sweeter, that's often why those big Californian wines, people say they're very sweet. They're not actually as sweet. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes their acidity is quite high, but the viscosity masks the acidity and you think they're sweet. Okay. So, how does this affect the subjectivity issue? Well, tastes or flavors, I think, are complex, but they're not so subjective that we can't make good predictions about them. We can do some science, we are doing it, we can have predictions about how certain flavors or experiences of flavor will change under certain conditions. Here's a nice one for you. Taste a Chianti or a Valpolicella. Most people say, oh, I like that kind of cherry flavor, but it's very bitter at the end. Ooh, didn't like the bitterness. Now you say, try a black olive. They eat the black olive, the salt cancels the bitterness. It's all perfect. It's as if they were made for each other. And guess what? They were. It's Italian food. We've lost our culture of having made wines that went with food because we can buy anything in the supermarket. We're having to relearn how to combine food and wine. We didn't have to. It was actually part of what people knew. Okay, sorry, I have to just quit that. Now, 2 minutes more and I'm done. I hope. Okay. Similarly, there is this thing called perceptual constancy, the fact that colours keep their, for you, their sort of colour, the colour of the door still looks blue even though the light changes and the tree casts a shadow on it. That's colour constancy. People say taste and smell don't have it, but they do, a bit. You can have wines that actually seem to fight back against some of the most aggressive and dangerous foods. Try a dry Pacherenc with asparagus soup. Wonderful, wonderful white wine, much neglected southern French wine. It really holds its own. You think, good for it, let's drink more Pacherenc. So of course we can make predictions about flavors. They're not as idiosyncratic and wild as we think. But puzzles remain. Why do people suppose they are idiosyncratic? Why doesn't everybody taste them? And why should we think experts are better at them? So to end, I want to just say something about us now. Taste is special because it's got these evaluative features. You don't just take something in. You take it in and you like it or you don't. It's very hedonic taste. You know, you either say yes, no, I like, I don't like. So that's very different from vision, and you might think it's very different from the other senses. And often, we don't know what we're tasting. We're tasting something, but we don't recognize it or we don't have a way of naming it. Okay. Now, because we're taking in what something is and then having a response to it, like or dislike, it's very easy to confuse those two things and to think they're just one. They come so hard on the heels. So sometimes you think, avocado just is disgusting. No, no. Avocado tastes of avocado and you don't like it, right? But you've got to first recognize this avocado to have that response. Also, it's not true that only taste has got this character of having an immediate hedonic or having a way in which, you know, it gives you a buzz and it doesn't give other people, or you hate it, they like it, Marmite, etc. I mean, you get that with the other senses too. The sound of nails being taken down a chalkboard, I can see some of you grimacing as I do it. It doesn't bother me at all, but it bothers a lot of people. I can see it bothers them. And then for me, there'll be fabrics I can't touch because it'll make my skin go cold. Other senses have this too, and you notice that people don't pattern. There are groups of people, they might be small groups. synesthesia, people will have color and hearing combinations, and that's rare. So taste is not so unusual, unlike everything else. It's hard to separate our response from liking from what we're tasting, and we often just tend to assume lazily everybody will like what we like. It's how we start as children. Okay, so this takes us to the nub of why we don't taste immediately what there is to taste, because it takes concentration, focused attention, and training. And I think part of what it takes, I want to just say this, part of what it takes is learning to focus less on ourselves. So sometimes when we drink something, we want to say, oh, what's it like? What's it like for me to drink a great Burgundy? But we have to go from what is it like for me to what is it like? What's the Burgundy like? And that means shifting our attention from ourselves to the object that's giving us an experience. And you have that shift even in tactile sensation. If I give you a box of fabrics and a blindfold and I said, rummage around in that box and see whether you can separate silk and satin and velvet, you can do it. And now I say to you, now stop doing that, just tell me what it feels like to touch, or think of what it feels like to touch velvet. Your attention shifts from the outside to the inside. You have an attention switch. It's now a focus on you. We haven't always learned to do that attention switch to get to the outside with tastes, and we should. Oops, annoying. And we should. Two more slides, I think. Okay. Here we go. So to do that shift of attention is something the novice finds more difficult. The novice begins with, I like it, so it's good. But we want to get to a point where we say, it's good and that's why I like it. You want to recognize what it is that's good about it. How does that come about? It comes about by learning to sort, not just by preference, but learning about wines, learning about their characteristics, learning about the varieties and not just your likings. It requires you to do lots and lots of tasting. And it also helps you to see what characteristics they do and don't have, and to come to see wines as achievements. They're more or less good as achievements. They're aiming to do something, they did or didn't make it. So what can we taste? Many things. Quality, precision, style. How do we learn to taste such things? We learn by training. And the hardest case is the case you're all used to. The hardest case is somebody gives you a glass of wine and says, what do you think? It's very hard. What do you compare it with? You've just got you and your experience and your memories in this glass of wine. That's the hardest thing to do. I gave you two wines tonight because it's much easier. When you go from one to the other, you notice they're different, you notice why they're different, you start to think about that. And this is for Simon. So I'll teach you differences, as from Shakespeare, and that Wittgenstein wanted as his epigraph. Is a very good motto. You actually are much better to start with comparisons. Okay, so if you want comparisons, you can compare horizontally. Look at the same year, look at the same maker and how he makes wines differently in different vineyards. You can do that in Burgundy. Look at the same maker over different years. See whether different vintages express different things. So what you can taste depends on how you taste. But can you do something as really impressive as tasting the history of a wine in a glass? Well, I want to leave you with a quote from a local boy. This is from Hugh Johnson. I think you can taste history in a glass. And here's a lovely quote. The difference between wines are genetically inherited. The vines and the vineyard are the bloodline. They're also acquired. When the vine is pruned, as the grapes ripen, when they're picked, as they're fermented and matured and bottled and stored again, the wine has its memories. Of the stony soil where the vine's roots probe deep, of the stone wall that gave it shelter, of the frost in May that reduced half of its shoots and the potential crop to brown bags, of the sun that crept up in the rose in the morning and left the grapes glowing as it went down, of the sudden cold showers. When a depression made its way from the Atlantic in September, drenching the dark firs on the hills, families sitting out for long days in the vineyard went back indoors and waited. The wine remembers it. The dry days of August, in the sweet jam-like concentration of its flavour, and the downpour before harvest, in a flicker of weakness as you swallow. Thank you.